Douglas Adams, the wonderful writer of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, said something wonderful about inventions that I think about a lot. He said, "Anything that was invented before you were born has always been there and is normal. Anything invented between the time that you were born and the time you're 30 is new and it's yours, and most likely you will make a living doing it. And finally, anything invented after 30 is wrong and needs to be stopped." I think about that second part in particular when I think about computers and the internet and how it collided with music. And in a lot of ways, it feels like we're still watching that collision happen. The first impact of computers on music happened in the mid to late 90s. And Douglas Adams was right. These new digital inventions ended up defining everything about music, music culture, and the music industry. And learning how it worked defined what working in music was in the 90s and the decade that followed. And it's still true today. As we deal with streaming services, AI, and surge pricing, it's also worth remembering that music on the internet was not always like this. The early 2000s saw the rise of the term Web 2.0. The internet became more about social media and engagement. But let's go back and look at Web 1.0, especially the music Web 1.0. And let's see how this all got started and how we got ourselves into this mess in the first place. Welcome to Just Ace, a podcast about the 90s Australian alternative music scene, whatever the hell that means. This week, we look at the early days of the music internet. In the 1990s, computers held a promise, especially for immigrant Asian families like mine. It wasn't like buying a Nintendo or a Sega. There was an educational element. It was something that a family could get if they wanted to get ahead. All the white kids were playing football. I should be learning computers. You would hear about cousins or other immigrant families getting computers. So, in 1995, we got a computer. We went to a place in the Sydney suburbs where my parents knew someone who made them. It was an Asian bloke who I was told to call uncle, but I never saw again. We went to see him like we went to see a doctor. We gave him what we needed, and he put something together in a big grey box, and he gave us a monitor that was the size of a milk crate and a keyboard and mouse that probably still work today. About half the computer was the fan. The big news at the time was, of course, Windows 95. Windows 95 was a milestone in computing. Microsoft had managed to take all the chatter about computers and market it as an everyday tool for their everyday home. Their new Windows 95 operating system was the simplest and most people-friendly ever. Computers were no longer a high-end luxury or the villain in a science fiction film. The big innovation with Windows 95 was the Start button, which Windows still has. And, in a legendary advertising tie-in, they used a 1981 Rolling Stones song, Start Me Up, in the ads. They gave that small struggling band $3 million. But that campaign was unforgettable. There are, of course, a couple of other cool rock and roll tie-ins with Windows 95. First, Windows 95 came with a bunch of video files to show off the video player. They had two music videos, one of Edie Brickell and one of Weezer's memorable Buddy Holly film clip. Neither artist were paid a cent. And the other one was the startup sound, which was composed by legendary producer Brian Eno. I don't think my journey into Windows 95 was that different from other teenagers. I played the games that came with the operating system, and I'm sure I kicked about with writing and spreadsheets. But for music, the main thing was the CD disc drive in the machine, and the headphone jack. After school, most days I would plug in and listen to music over and over, and play on the computer. I was too young to own a Walkman. This was the first time I could just listen to music at home without disturbing other people. I was able to get lost in a world of music whilst other people cooked or read the newspaper whilst I was sweeping mines. But then we got this extra box to go with the computer called a modem, and suddenly the possibilities were endless. That distinctive dial-up sound that a modem makes is ingrained in my head and probably the heads of most people my age, which is why it's so often used as a joke. That ever-distinctive dial-up crackle held a promise. I probably dialed up to use the internet several times a night. It's so funny to think that you had to be off the phone to get on the internet at all. Getting yelled at to get off the internet was common. A few years later, we would get a second dedicated phone line for the internet. And that just seemed like the most extravagant spending, but it did stop some fights. I don't know how much of the internet I saw in 1995. It was probably just very little of it. So much of what I knew from the internet was from comic books and magazines. Comic books in particular seemed to constantly be pushing comic book websites. In America, they were just a little bit ahead of Australia, and they had this thing called AOL, American Online, and there was often full-page ads in American comic books advertising AOL. AOL was an internet service provider, but it was more like pay TV. You not only got access to the internet, you got access to exclusive AOL stuff. Before URLs became common, you would type in a keyword in AOL and something would come up. You would type in the keyword Marvel into AOL, for example, and Marvel's website would come up. AOL never quite took hold in Australia, but the internet was international, and hunting online to find cool stuff was hard. Where do you even start? Well, first you needed some software, and sometimes you had to buy it. Software would come in big boxes and sometimes be spread over several floppy disks. As the 90s went on, they adopted the CD and used CDs to hold data and not music. It was pretty common to get discs from computer magazines at the local newsagent. You could get the latest browser, like the latest version of Netscape, or the latest email reader, like Eudora, or the latest messenger program, like AOL's own Instant Messenger. AOL loved giving away CDs with their software. If they could be counted, I reckon AOL discs were probably the highest owned compact disc in the world in the 90s. In Australia, with no AOL, you had to sign up with a local internet company to get online. There were usually new, small companies like Zipworld, Hunterlink, AlphaLink, iHug, or AussieMail. The big telecommunications giants wouldn't get involved until a lot later. But using the software you had, you could now start clicking around. Browsers could help you find content, but it was the early search engines that got you started. Lycos, AltaVista, or Yahoo had these pages that had lots and lots of links for you to consider. Ask Jeeves was someone's attempt to make a search engine that was friendlier to the casual crowd. But you started with a homepage and you'd click on their suggested sites and you'd go from there. Yahoo was the big search engine in these days, and Yahoo was sorted by humans. Their homepage had directories, like lots and lots of links. You could click through a link that was a category, like music, and it would take you to more pages with more links. It would go on to be a bazillion-dollar tech company. It would go on to buy Channel 7 in Australia. But it started like a library catalogue. Early adopter companies built rudimentary websites. Just a few pages about themselves, like a sales flyer, come to life. But it was really the personal homepage that built the early internet. It starts with GeoCities, and it is as important to the history of popular music as any other website. But it was also so much more than music. GeoCities was a service where people could make their own web pages. It was started by Americans David Bonnet and John Reznor in 1994. People from all over the world could sign up and get a bit of space on the internet to call their own. You didn't have to learn anything about hosting or URLs. Your page would be sorted under a section called a neighborhood. These neighborhoods usually had a clever name like Area 51 for sci-fi, or Hollywood for films, or Broadway for theater. The music side was called Sunset Strip. These neighborhoods would be part of your website URL. And later there would be neighborhoods within neighborhoods. I quickly found myself in the world of GeoCities, and I made my very first bit of content on the internet. This didn't feel like a big step, it was just another fun thing on the internet to try. To make a GeoCities site, you had to learn a little bit of HTML, which I did. I had time because I was a teenager and there was no TikTok. So I learned the basic building blocks of coding myself. GeoCities made money by selling ads that would appear on your profile page. In fact, later social media like MySpace, arguably, took what was best about GeoCities and made it even easier by supplying pre-made profile pages. But in the mid-90s, GeoCities was all customization. And yeah, they looked awful in retrospect. They say write what you know, and my first web pages were all about me. The same was true for thousands of others. My first pages were called Danny's Homepage. But because of GeoCities' neighborhood system, I had to pick a neighborhood to define myself. And I chose my first love, which was comic books, and I made some pages about DC comic books I loved. Remember, we were starting from zero. None of this stuff was online. I copied images and I put them under Area 51, the comic book neighborhood. I also managed to get the email address dannyyao@geocities.com. Did I use Comic Sans all over my personal homepage? Did I ever? Did I use bright neon colors? Of course. Were there animated GIFs? I couldn't get enough of them. Did I have under construction signs that looked like real under construction signs? You betcha. I can only say that because it was new, it was fun to make it not look like anything else. Black text on white was done. We wanted it to look different from a Word document. For many people, GeoCities was the start of learning about making web pages. If anything, it encouraged you to do it. At the bottom of every GeoCities site, there was a footer that said, "This page was hosted by GeoCities," and then a link to get your own free homepage. As a curious teenager, why wouldn't you click through? Yet, it was odd. This was a medium that encouraged you to participate and make more of it. You don't watch TV to find a show about how to make and broadcast your own TV show. GeoCities invited you to make some internet, and I was one of many people to happily accept that invitation. The next step after GeoCities was a personal homepage on my own space, and in the early days of the internet, it would be pretty easy to get some space. Many internet service providers in the 90s gave you a piece of the internet to call your own, to create a homepage. It just came with the service. You get internet, an email address, and then some space on the web if you wanted it. My service provider was one called Zip. My username, brilliantly, for many years was just Danny. So my email was danny@zip.com.au. And my personal webpage would be at zip.com.au/tilde Danny. Tildes are these little squiggly line characters on the keyboard and are about as 90s as it gets. I don't think I've genuinely used a tilde since 1999. These personal websites took a bit more programming and coding know-how. You had to build them from scratch and upload the files. Because I learned from GeoCities, I had learned the basics of creating a website from scratch. And soon a hobby became a skill. So there I was, putting myself on the internet for the world to see. But of course, most of the world never saw it. It felt so innocent and small. And it's not like I was putting anything real about myself online. I didn't even have a digital photo of myself. It was just some pages about comic books and what the hell, maybe I'd create a few new pages about some of the music that I liked as well. When I started building out pages about one of the bands that I liked, UMI, there was no plan. It was maybe one better than having a little scrapbook of your favourite band. I copied some photos, wrote out some lyrics, listed what I liked about them, and that was that. If you looked at my high school art books, there were photos of Regurgitator and their lyrics written out. Why not? You should have seen all the band names that were on my pencil case. Music pages online didn't feel that different from writing band names on your pencil case. There were lots of sites like this. Someone's personal page and a few bands they liked. I remember someone named Jezza who had pages on Spiderbait, Regurgitator and UMI. It was hosted on GeoCities, and then Jezza linked to other fan pages, and other fan pages linked to him. And soon my UMI pages were linked to Jezza's and every other UMI pages I could find, such as Moonshine, a UMI site, Mr. Milk Online, Count to Four and others. And then they linked back to me, and it was now a web of links, as they called it. There was no filter, we just listed everything. I didn't call it Danny Yao's UMI page. I came up with a much more clever name of UMI and Me, whatever the hell that means. It could be found at www.zip.com.au/tildedanny/UMI. I love those other UMI pages, because I didn't really know that much else about the band before those pages. I read every word on their one or two or three page deep sites about UMI. I mean, it took all of 15 minutes, but they were my favourite band. Of course, it wasn't just UMI pages. There were pages for so many bands, and you could click around on GeoCities and find websites for Weezer or Regurgitator or Pearl Jam or so much more. And it wasn't just the web. There was also a lot of ways to interact with people. There were Usenet newsletters and newsletter digests. There were forums and chat channels. I flirted with some of this stuff, but this is, again, the important thing about having something that you loved. Because I would get past the weirdness of the new and just jump into chats because I loved these bands. But behind these chats and forums and newsletters were people, and I started to make friends. I had friends at school, I was never a lonely kid, I could always fit in, but I started chatting to people online. The world seemed small and I'm sure there were scams and abuse at the time, but I only met like-minded nerds, some of which went on to be really good friends. Instant Messenger was the most important program for this. AIM was big, but I preferred ICQ. It was just a little program where you could add people. Next to every name was a flower, and when it was green, it meant that someone was happy to chat. It wasn't just the technology that made it possible. It was the time. I was a teenager, and I had time to talk all night, just like how I used to talk on the phone all night. But I could talk to a variety of people for hours on end. They'd hop on and off. I had people on my ICQ list from all around the country. I would add school friends and cousins and people I met at all-age gigs. A lot of them were teenagers or early adults too, with nothing to do. As a generation, we started to get to know each other through the safety of chat windows. I know people who met on ICQ and fell in love. I'm sure many people got married. I made important friendships. I would talk to girls I liked. I still remember conversations I had on there decades later. I fondly remember conversations with people who have since passed away. There was a lot of talk around this time about the internet isolating people. In my experience, it was far from it. I learned so much about people. Whereas outside of the computer, I had mates, but not like this. I probably spoke to more people by the time I was 20 than my parents did in their entire lives, thanks to things like ICQ. ICQ would last for several more years, but it was one of the several things that social media would kill off. But for a while, it was magical. And these were the years that music became my life. And I think part of it was because of the internet, and there was so much that I could really obsess over. The internet had infinite pages, and even those pages would get updated. I could talk about music all day at school, and then I could go home and read about them or talk about music every night on my computer. Other interests like comics and footy fell away, and I wonder if it was because the websites of those things weren't as good, or if I just got caught up in music and fell down that rabbit hole. Here is modern life in 1997. I was like thousands, if not millions, of teenage kids doing the same thing. I was coming of age between Windows 95 and the next big change for music, which I would say was Napster, but that's later. Every day I would use that dial-up modem. I would surf the net with the latest Netscape Navigator 3.0 or 4.0 because versions were important. I would search and read music websites. Above and beyond the fan sites, there was the Triple J website or the Recovery website. There was also international bands. AllMusic.com was a great resource to learn about music from previous decades. I had nothing to do but to read them all. I would listen to my growing CD collection on headphones, through the computer, usually playing CDs through Winamp. I would start making lists of my CD collection. I would answer emails in Eudora. I would chat to friends on ICQ. I would play early games like Minesweeper and Pinball. I would occasionally use the disk defragmenter to make my computer run better, but also watch my computer data arrange itself into satisfying rows. If you know, you know. I also learned to play guitar. My brother suggested I take lessons, to which I told him people like Jimi Hendrix and Paul McCartney never took lessons. And he told me I wasn't Paul McCartney. But Paul McCartney didn't have online guitar tabs. I wonder if I would be the fan of Australian music I am today if it wasn't for guitar tabs. Because I spent extra time listening to that music because I spent extra time working out how to play those Even and Pollyanna songs. Of course, I would also spend my time working on my little website and work on web design. I would learn, copy, and read all about it. I read about web design on blogs by people like Jeffrey Zeldman. I used long-forgotten programs like Microsoft's FrontPage and Hotdog. When I saw some website layout I liked, I learned how to replicate it and make my own version. I could literally copy the code. I saw a site where they had buttons, but the buttons changed when your mouse cursor moved over it. So I could look at the code, see it was a mouse over tag, and then all my site's buttons did that cool trick. I probably changed the look of the UMI site every 6 months because it was fun to try. The energy and effort I put in was no different from people who made fanzines or fan clubs or indie comics a few years earlier. But when you mix that passion and energy with a Windows NT computer, you got fan sites. I started filling the gaps on UMI for the internet. I started listing all their discography and writing a history from stuff I learnt from interviews. I started transcribing the lyrics really badly. My local library, Campsie Library, had a computer and a scanner that you could book. The scanner was a long-defunct hand scanner. Scanning it was like ironing a shirt. I would book time at the library after school, armed with magazines and CD singles, and scan them in. There was no online copy of the Mr. Milk single cover, so I had to go and scan that, and I put the first copy up on the internet. I was basically taking bits and pieces from everywhere and putting it online. And I was far from the only one. For me, as important as Triple J or Recovery in terms of supporting and discovering Australian alternative music, was the community that built organically around it online. And one of the key websites for me was called Oz Music Central, run by Paul Stipak. I was busy on one band, but Paul was working on a website that promoted several that he liked. I copied a lot from Paul. Paul ran a Powderfinger page called Oipic. Part of the page was a Powderfinger mailing list called Econodog. So I copied him and I started a UMI mailing list called Punkarella. He had a concert chronology, which was a good idea, so I made a UMI concert chronology, and so on. He made pages for the Super Jesus, Finiscad, and others. And he also made one for UMI, which was called Moonshine. The other thing Paul did was start the All Australian Guitar Tab page. Paul was a guitar player as well and had written some tabs for UMI and other Australian bands. I came along and tabbed a few extra songs, the ones that Paul didn't do. Lots of other people would contribute to Paul's site with tabs for dozens, if not hundreds, of Australian bands. I don't know why Paul took this line of keeping it Australian. There were other tab sites I could tell you about where some guy just did Pearl Jam tabs here and Oasis tabs there and just whatever they worked out. But Paul made his page Australian artists only, and more than just the music that he liked. I assume it was just to keep it manageable and distinctive, and because it was the 90s and guitars, it lent heavily alternative. Through his sites, Paul was one of the first people to make this Australian alternative music thing feel like its own scene. I would say Paul started it, but he wasn't the only one. There were a few directories of Australian music after a while. Oz Music Scrapbook, run by Matt Attlee, and the Oz Music Project, run by Jasper Lee, were both sites that I loved. Oz Music Project would go and get a few other writers as well. It felt a lot like fanzines, but digital. It was a lot of music enthusiasts who wanted to be writers and publishers. The defining of this Australian music scene continued with Webrings. It's a totally lost technology, but Webrings were a little carousel of links around a theme. And you could click on the next site or a random site or other ways to explore websites that are part of this ring. There was an Aussie band Webring. My UMI page was proudly part of the Webring. Like GeoCities, the internet kind of forced people into defining themselves. An international alternative rock band ring would have been too much and you'd never find anything. Later on, there was a Brisbane band Webring, which just shows that the Aussie band Webring was getting too big. There was also a way for people to click to vote for Australian music sites on a chart run by a company called Hit Squad. My UMI page, UMI and Me, got to number 9 at one point. Someone started the Australian Online Music Awards in 1999 as well. It was called the Onyas. I never even got nominated. But again, it was just another way that Australian music was almost like its own genre. So unlike Triple J or Juice or Street Press or any of the other media I talked about, these websites did more to define the Australian alternative music scene as its own scene. The fans and the kids saw Australian music this way, and I'm not sure the established media ever really got that. I don't know why, but at some point, Paul got too busy to run his UMI site. The thing about all these fan sites is that they were passion projects. It's the reason so many of them last a year or two and then die an internet death. Life just gets in the way. Around the same time, another UMI website went down that was run by Peter Calvert, who would go on to found the website Mono. When her website died and Paul stepped away from his, I took over a lot of the content. The original idea was that I would turn my website into one under the Oz Music Central banner, and that this new website would be called UMI Central. But there wasn't like any agreement or anything. I never even met Paul in person, but I was happy to power up. Rusty from UMI, the managers and the label were following the website. They had signed up to the mailing lists, and it made sense. It was an era of things like street teams, and they asked if they could start posting information to the mailing list. Which, of course, I said yes. UMI's label had flirted with the idea of an official website, but instead of giving it to the label, the band offered me the URL for umi.com.au and just let me run it. So I got to run this fan site and fan club for UMI. But I felt part of a community of great websites for Australian music. We all grew together and did similar things. As well as Econa Dogs and Punkarella, there were lots of mailing lists that I was on. There was Custard and Regurgitator mailing lists. Silver Chairs was called the Llama Appreciation Society. There was the Friends of the Whitlams. Even had one called Dear Morris. I spun out a forum because I saw other websites had forums. I had a hit counter because every other website had them. I added a guestbook and chats. Everyone had photos, articles, and discographies. I ran competitions. There was a short-lived service that allowed people to get their own email address using my domain. This is what music websites were doing. This was fun. And I wasn't the only one being spun out to be official, or at least officially sanctioned. Silverchair's fan page chair page became official. Craig Harmon's Hotel Motel Jebediah became official. Friends of the Ends, a Crowded House fan club run by the great Peter Green, took over the online presence of Neil Finn's solo work. In a way, and I say this with all humbleness, UMI was lucky to have someone like me. Other bands in the 90s didn't have a nerd they knew that could just build all this for them from scratch. I got a few offers to run websites for other bands, but UMI was where my passion was. Around this time, in street press and magazines, in the late 90s, the launch an official website by an Australian band would be a press release and a news item. But there were still plenty of great sites that were proudly unofficial. I love D.F. Hanna's work on his unofficial Custard site, which included producing a fanzine. I think Custard and their management team just felt slightly differently about official sites than you or I, who were happy to hand it over to some kid. It's worth noting that for most of the record labels, they probably wished we would all go away. And D.F. Hanna's cusszine was fantastic, and shows that the line between a zine maker and a fan site maker was really just pixels and paper. Looking at a web archived 1999 page of Australian band links from Paul's Oz Music Central, there were several hundred sites listed, from Big Heavy Stuff to Snout to Beaverloop to, of course, the bigger ones. Some had one fan site. Some, like Regurgitator, UMI and Jebediah, had half a dozen sites. Jebediah had its own band ring at one point. Some were official, some were proudly unofficial. Some were called Monty's Eskimo Joe page or Anthony's Spiderbait page. Some were hosted on GeoCities or an ISP page. There was a little bit of everything. It also felt very alternative, whatever the hell that means. Maybe it was just numbers. There was just so many more of these new guitar bands. But there weren't so many fan sites for pop bands at the time. There was something about the early intense fandom of indie kids that suited this new internet fan site movement. Who was missing was the bands from the early 90s. There were no pages for the Hummingbirds, Falling Joys or Ratcat. The Clouds survived long enough to get a fan site and a mailing list, but this was very much a snapshot of bands that were around in the late 90s. I had so much fun running the UMI site, and the fans were very creative. There was a tribute tape that the fans put together. I did some coordination, but all the hard work was done by fans who worked out how to do it. Fans recorded cover versions of UMI songs and we sent them to anyone who wanted them. We made Christmas mixtapes. People would get one and make a copy and send it on. Several people made UMI desktop themes. You could change the colours and icons of your whole desktop to look like High Fireway or Number 4 Record. Someone also made an Owly Daily font. That strange scribbly writing on the cover could be used in any context. People's creativity was often surprising and delightful. And again, it's powered by their love of something. There was an active bootleg network. People would tape shows and trade them with each other. That soon extended to other bands that were similar to UMI, like the Posies or Sloan. American fans would tape shows and swap them for Australian shows. For a while, I felt like I needed to organise the chats and be active in the forums, but I quickly learnt that that wasn't true, because people just wanted to make friends with each other. They didn't need me. I could have been anyone. There was a community around UMI Central and the Punkarella mailing list that was built by fans. I just did the coding. And I know there were similar stories from other mailing lists and fan sites, like Econodog and Friends of the Whitlams. It wasn't about the newsletter or the designs, it was about making friends and chatting and finding people like you. In 1998, as a sign of the times, Triple J released a book called Triple J's Internet Music Guide. You might chuckle at the idea of a book that lists and reviews websites, but it seemed very normal at the time. There was a whole industry of internet magazines around at this time as well. Again, without great search engines, you relied on recommendations and guides to find things. And recommendations from printed guides like magazines or books were as good as anything. The Triple J Internet Music Guide really felt like an expanded magazine. It is small and pocket-sized, if you had big pockets, and it was only 160 pages long. It was written by music writer Stuart Coop and Triple J's own Richard Kingsmill. And now, as much of this internet has been wiped away, it's a fascinating snapshot of this era. My UMI site was reviewed. I got 3 stars out of 5. They didn't just review Australian sites either, but they only reviewed around 50 sites out of a possible 50 million, so it's a bit arbitrary. The best thing about the book in retrospect was a few of the interviews in it, which captured how people felt about these sites at the time. Silverchair's manager, John Watson, talked about the benefits of ChairPage and how it was a vital part of the marketing. They could reach more fans directly than the label's own marketing team. Tim Stewart from Screamfeeder says he liked the fan sites more than he liked the official Screamfeeder one. It also captures a bit of the wider internet culture beyond band websites, like the big music websites at the time. Like Rolling Stone magazine's website, which had the wonderful, memorable URL of www.rollingstone.com/sections/home/text/default.asp. The internet became the cool thing to tap into by the late 90s. Also in 1998, Triple J launched a new show called The Net 50. It was a request show, essentially, where people could vote for songs they liked. But here's the catch. You had to do it online, on the internet. I'm not clear what the inference was. Was it that this list could be more cutting edge because it was an online audience? They also started having a webcam in the studio that you could watch on their website. In 1997, ARIA implemented a digital way of collecting sales for data in their charts. But to go with it, they gave it a new name, ARIANET. ARIANET had nothing to do with the net. It just sounded like the cool name. You like the internet, don't you, kids? It was a trend that people were jumping on. TISM called their 1998 album www.tism.wanker.com. Custard mentions a URL in their song Monkey off 1999's Loverama. Regurgitator's unit was a lot of feelings about computers. Films like Hackers and The Net had come along. David Bowie became an internet service provider in 1998. Britney Spears had a song on her first album in 1999 called Email My Heart. Computer and internet culture was everywhere, and we all thought that the Y2K bug was going to end the world anyway. But it wasn't Y2K in the end, but something else would come along and destroy this entire world. The most successful year in music history was 1999. In terms of pure sales and the money made on recorded music, 1999 continued the trend of the 90s of music getting bigger year after year. The most successful month in music history was December 1999, the Christmas rush of that landmark year. Britney Spears' first album, Backstreet Boys' Millennium. There was a Celine Dion best of, Blink-182's Enema of the State, Shania Twain's Come On Over, and that damn Dido album that was everywhere. In Australia, Powderfinger, The Living End, and Silverchair all had albums in the top 25 highest-selling albums of 1999. In America, they had to introduce an accreditation above gold and platinum. Platinum was 1 million sales, and the new diamond accreditation was 10 million. That's how good 1999 was. But that was it, 1999, and then the good times ended. Because Napster came along in 1999 and got really popular in 2000. Napster was just another program, the latest thing to try and download, like creating a GeoCities site or signing up to a mailing list. The new buzz was peer-to-peer sharing, but what it really meant was that I could access files on another person's computer and they could access mine if I allowed it. But the thing about Napster wasn't what it could do, it was the ease of how easily it could be done. And a few bits of technology had come together to make it a success. First, there was the MP3. There was music on the internet before the MP3. There was the popular Real Audio format, which was just a small file that linked to an online stream. Radio stations had started to stream online through Real Audio, but you couldn't download and own Real Audio. WAV files existed and was commonly used for sounds on your computer, but they were big. The sounds on a Windows computer, like the Brian Eno startup sound, was a large WAV file that only lasted a few seconds. The full WAV files for a complete album could be larger than your computer's hard disk drive, so it wasn't practical. But the new MP3 format could make music files small. A little algorithm developed by German digital scientists worked out a balance between sounding okay and the files being manageable. And on dial-up, it meant a song could be downloaded in like 25 minutes. Some artists had started offering the odd MP3 download on their website. You could play MP3s on a few music players. But like Real Audio, you pretty much had to listen to them on your computer. On top of that, there was also MP3 ripping technology becoming easily available. Previously, copying music off a CD wasn't that easy. And then came the blank CD. In the 90s, blank CDs cost hundreds of dollars. But by the late 90s, they were just a couple of dollars. Add to that the price coming down on CD burners as well, and you could burn these MP3s onto a CD and listen to these songs anywhere. I remember that Napster interface clearly. Mainly I remember the lists and lists of songs. Thousands, hundreds of thousands, probably everything ever. Just so many of these small MP3 files that I could download. I didn't need to download the music I already loved and owned. What came first for me was bootlegs or live recordings and radio sessions. Even now, I have hundreds of bootlegs of bands that I downloaded around this time. I really loved that band Wilco, and I have hundreds of Wilco shows. And because it's what you did in the 90s, I took those MP3s and I burnt them onto CDs. But as time went on, it was easy to see that new music was just as easy to download as it was to buy. In fact, it was easier. I didn't even have to leave my desk to get it. And Napster wasn't the only site that offered what we would later realize was illegal downloads. But Napster was the most popular and visible. And before the decade was out, we had the first people to ever be sued for illegal downloading. The Napster uproar was strange and hilarious. It was hard to get your head around as a kid. Especially in those early days when so much of the music that was downloaded was not commercially available. But as Napster got bigger, the more that it too hit the mainstream. The weirdness of it culminates for me at the MTV Video Music Awards of the year 2000. There was a moment where the show just cut to a sketch with no introduction. I watched it live and suddenly we were in a bedroom with a teenager played by the comedian and not teenager Marlon Wayans. He's rocking out to music in his bedroom and on his desk is a computer with Napster open. But it's not actually Napster, it's just a screen with a big Napster logo. The whole thing is very cartoonish. Then Lars Ulrich of Metallica arrives. He proceeds to lecture the teenager on fairness and then steals all his stuff, including his computer and his girlfriend, because that's the equivalent of what Napster was doing. It was heavy-handed, tone-deaf, and very strange. Here's a clip.
Well, except for that bad show you hosted.
You know what? Maybe I wouldn't have to whore myself out if you kids didn't steal my music.
Whoa. We're not stealing, okay? We're just sharing with each other, you know?
So it's like if I take this soda can right here, take a sip out of it.
Oh my God! I'm sharing my soda with Lars Ulrich!
And you know what? I'm just sharing 10 years of groupies with you, frat boy.
It would be a long fight that would take us beyond the 90s, but music was never the same again. But that's the story of another decade. Douglas Adams, the wonderful writer of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, said something wonderful about inventions that I think about a lot. He said that anything that was invented before you were born has always been there and is normal. Anything invented by the time you're 30 is new, and it's yours, and most likely you will make a living doing it. And finally, anything invented after you're 30 is wrong and needs to be stopped. And let's look at that last part, because music still seems to change. Trying not to be the guy who thinks progress needs to be stopped is something that I work on every day. I find it kind of amazing that my parents bought me a computer and just let me go. They weren't afraid and they didn't think anything was wrong and needed to be stopped. They even allowed us to get that second phone line. They didn't understand it. They struggled with technology after the VCR, but they let me do it, and it gave me a head start in life. I went on to build a lot of websites for bands and record companies, and I saw the world because of it. But fan sites got wiped out. I would say that MySpace co-opted some of what was good about them. Record companies took the websites back. The internet became big business. WebRings was bought by GeoCities, who was bought by Yahoo. Netscape, Eudora, ICQ, all shut up shop. The internet destroyed physical products, old school press, and how we communicated. But newer internet also wiped out the older internet. And hey, what is around right now will get wiped out too. Some of the people who started fan sites in the 90s ended up, predictably, working in tech. Craig from Hotel Motel Jebediah started a web company. Paul from Oz Music Central did web development at the ABC and Triple J. I built the first Warner Music Australia website. And I guess it's just that alternative versus mainstream cycle all over again. The fan site world, I would argue, was so comparable to the underground fanzine world of the 80s. But the underground, whether it was fanzines, bands, or tech nerds, get bought out. We just call them startups these days. There's so much more to say about technology and music in the next decade and beyond. iPod, iTunes, Spotify, MySpace, LimeWire, Ping, remember Ping? Pirate Bay, Facebook, Bandcamp, search pricing, AI, and more. Just Ace has one episode about digital culture. In a podcast about the next decade, every second episode would be about something digital. I could say so much more about Napster. I could also say so much about Audio Galaxy and LimeWire and copy protection. And then I could go on about MySpace, MP3 players and more. But I have to stop somewhere. The story of technology and music and all art is constantly changing. We make art for technology and we receive art through technology. We are still going to need great songs, but who knows how they'll be delivered. But what we do know is that there's just no way that what works now is going to work in a few years' time. To end, Oz Music Project, this website that was dedicated to just Australian alternative music, died a sudden death in 2004. When they died, they were in the middle of publishing a top 100 Australian albums of the 90s list, as voted by their writers, some of whom were close friends of mine. They were also my age and loved the things that I did. They are a bit younger than the magazine writers of the time, and 2004 is a very short runway of historical perspective. But still, it's a list very much worth having a look at. They published up to number 71 before the site died. Jasper, the site's former owner, was very graceful and sent me the list a few years back and has shared it online since. I'll link to a playlist of it and I'll share the link in socials. But here's a snapshot of a different generation's view of our music. Here's the top 10 Australian albums of the 90s as voted for by the Oz Music Project team. From 10 to 1, they are Silverchair Neon Ballroom at 10, Underground Lovers Dream It Down at 9, Nick Cave's The Good Son at 8, Something for Kate's Elsewhere for 8 Minutes at 7, Cloud's Penny Century at 6, UMI's Ali Daily at 5, Powderfinger's Double Allergic at 4, Ratcat's Blind Love at 3, Magic Dirt's Life Was Better at number 2, and UMI's Hi-Fi Way at number 1. So to end with some music, here's a track from that number one Australian album of the 90s, as voted for by the Oz Music Project team. It was also the name of the mailing list that I ran in the 90s for UMI. Here's the song Punkarella. Don't you wish that your kids all look more fine? Do you feel that your girls below your style? Edible slippers and a drink on the Sunday mail. Coffee teeth and a cigarette hung for sale. Any minute now something's gonna happen. Thanks for listening and welcome to the end bit. This is the bit where I talk about different ways to support the podcast and keeping it going and keeping it ad-free. So many independent podcasts have a Patreon and I'm no different. I have a Patreon that is just one tier, a support tier. There's only a year or so left in this podcast, so signing up to help will probably cost you around the same as a vinyl record, or possibly less. You know how vinyl prices are these days. It's just an easy way to help out. You can opt out at any time, and it's about giving what you can. There's also a tipping service for one-off donations called Buy Me a Coffee. Links to both are in the description. There's also stuff you can buy, like the new book, which adapts the first two seasons of the podcast into book form. There's also a bit of merch on the Redbubble store, where you can order t-shirts or tote bags or other fun things. There's no-cost ways of helping too. You can leave me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or on Amazon if you've bought a book. You can also follow me on social media, share the posts, or simply tell a friend. Spreading the word is important for podcasts. All the links that you need are in the description, as well as links to the website and socials where you will find notes and more info about the scene and each episode. That's it. Next week, we look at how indie rock crashed into the mansion on the hill.
Hi, this is John from Fove's Other Best People. We review each and every song from legendary Australian rock group, The Fove's. From Misguided Modelling Career to Dog's Other Best People. From Celebrate the Failure to Simon Tahiti. Are you a fan of The Fove's? Give Fove's Other Best People a spin. Available from wherever you get your podcasts, and at fovespodcast.com.